In Virginia, the cost of certain breast cancer screenings will be billed to the insurance company, not the patient. Again, those new laws and others will begin taking effect tomorrow, Tuesday, July 1st. In today's weather, it's currently about 92 degrees in D.C. That's all for your headline news this hour. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Please be safe, and thank you for listening.
From the Inside Out Collective, and you are enjoying The House That Wanda Built on WPFW Washington.
Peace, good people. It's Dapo from the Inside Out Collective and A Gay Old Time and the Fellowship Hall. Back in 2023, Jay Barber and I had an interview with June Crenshaw in honor of The House That Wanda Built. She's the former executive director of the Wanda Alston Foundation. She just stepped down, and Cesar Toledo is now the new executive director. But we hope you enjoy this interview, and we hope you're enjoying this day of programming. Much love to you all, and much love to the legacy and life of Wanda Alston here on WPFW Washington.
Yo, yo, yo. Good afternoon, and thanks for tuning in to Inside Out LGBT Radio Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM. My name is Jay Barber, and I'm one of the co-hosts of the Fellowship Hall. We would like to thank you for joining us for WPFW Presents The House That Wanda Built 2023, our sixth annual Pride special day of programming. Today, from 9 until midnight, we are broadcasting voices, discussing issues, present music, and honoring the life and legacy of Wanda Alston. Before we hop onto this special episode of Fellowship Hall, I want to tell you more about Inside Out. Inside Out is a collective that illuminates and celebrates the rich diversity that is the LGBTQIA+ experience. This groundbreaking show has aired since 2008 and is DC's only show of its kind on FM dial and one of the only of a handful in the country. We take you inside this community to look at everything from pop culture to politics through an LGBTQIA inclusive lens. We are proud to be a part of the legacy of cutting edge public affairs programming on WPFW, home of Jazz and Justice Radio. Inside Out airs every Monday at 6 p.m. on 89.3 FM and WPFWFM.org. All right, let's hop into the show. I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Dapo, who's going to tell you more about this afternoon's episode.
What's up, everybody? Thank you, Jay Barber. Hello, hello. Oh, man, The House That Wanda Built. Shout out. Happy Pride, everybody. I'm Dapo, she, her, hers pronouns. Today, we are so honored to be joined by June Crenshaw, the executive director of the Wanda Alston Foundation. But before we bring June on, we would love to play a tribute to the wonderful Wanda Alston by Kurt Vondran. So Khalil, our wonderful engineer, is going to hold us down and get that clip going and take a listen.
Hi, this is Kurt Vondran. I knew Wanda Alston from activism in the LGBTQ community here in Washington, D.C. Soon after Anthony Williams became mayor of our city, I was elected president of what was then called the Stein Democratic Club and still is the leading LGBTQ political organization in DC. Wanda had an interest in serving as Mayor Williams' liaison to our community, and I had strongly encouraged the mayor to hire her, which he did. With her being inside government and me heading an outside activist organization, we got a lot done together. Wanda was an absolute whirlwind in the job, and it was hard to keep up with her. We talked on the phone about every other day, but I'm not sure she ever understood that I didn't actually work for her. It was always, Kurt, you need to do that, or Kurt, I need this done. Wanda quickly decided that her job was not just as a conduit, for the established activists to relate to the mayor and DC government. She believed the mayor needed to hear directly from the margins of our community. I remember she organized a meeting with Mayor Williams himself to directly hear from a diverse array of people and experiences not usually heard from in our community. One of the most poignant issues that came up was homelessness among LGBTQ youth. Homeless youth were an invisible part of our community, and the activist groups were focused at that time on other things like marriage equality. This was the beginning of what would later become the Wanda Alston House.
Much, Kurt. Thank you. Oh, man. So check it out, guys. We have the wonderful June Crenshaw, the executive director of the Wanda Alston Foundation. Welcome, June. Happy Pride. And thank you so much for being here. June, please introduce yourself, including pronouns, your role at the organization, and all it is that you do.
I am so thrilled to be here with you guys talking about this. And so moved by the powerful words of Kurt. My name is June Crenshaw. My pronouns are she, her, hers. And I'm the executive director of the Wanda Alston Foundation. Our mission is to eradicate poverty and homelessness experienced by LGBTQIA two-spirited youth. And we provide those services through our shelters, our case management, through therapy, through life skills development, through our support with educational opportunities, including scholarships for our youth and employment opportunities. We also do a lot of advocacy for resources to come to the LGBTQIA two-spirited community through our membership with the Budget Coalition, where we advocate for comprehensive resources for the queer community. We are also a member of the Youth Economic Justice Coalition. And there we advocate for shelter, for mental health services, for work support and work development skills services. And then finally, we are members of the Victims Assistance Network. And that work is around the intimate partner violence and sexual assault that occurs in our community. And we do a lot of training and advocacy and outreach and support, emergency shelter, therapy, and case management to our community that's impacted by intimate partner violence. So there's a lot of work that we're doing, so proud of doing this work and excited to be here talking about it, but also talking about its origin.
I love it. Thank you so much. You all do all of the things. And also, I took a note of how I was seeing it, LGBTQIA2. I love that, including the two-spirit. I love how we include even within our, I know we're marginalized, but we're trying to make sure that we don't marginalize anybody within our community. So shout out to that. So many things that you guys do. I actually used to be a kind of a caseworker, and I definitely sent students to the Wanda Alston Foundation home and things of that nature. But I know things are very different now. We're post-COVID, like COVID is over, big quotes, big air quotes, but we're post, you know, post-pandemic, post-quarantine. Tell me, how has the mental health of the youth been impacted by COVID, like isolation, everybody's still resetting? Or tell us more about how that has affected the youth that you all are working with.
I love that we're starting with that question, because although we are celebrating Pride this month, and there are so many things that we should be celebrating around, there's still a lot of things that are happening in our community that often doesn't get the focus and attention that it needs. And so mental health is one of those things, right? There's so much stigma around it. But your question around the impact of the pandemic, like our kids were devastated, right?
Yeah.
So If you can imagine that they had already experienced the rejection of being, you know, kind of kicked out of their homes because of their queer identity or their sexual orientation, they had already been traumatized and had experienced such high levels of rejection. Then the pandemic came. Right. And that created additional isolation and additional, you know, just trauma around, you know, not having real access and connection to new community they might have been building. One of the things that happened in for the kids that were in our program is each and every one of them lost their jobs. So no one had any income or any resources coming in. They were set back in their work toward independence and building up their resources. And so they were stuck for 2+ years in the same spot of not evolving, not, you know, saving money like so many other members of the community were able to do, continue to, you know, draw their income while not spending money, et cetera. It was a reverse for the LGBTQIA2 spirited youth experiencing homelessness. There was really a pretty significant setback. And all of that stress caused an adverse impact on their mental health.
Indeed.
And so, like, they suffered and I think are really continuing to do so.
Yeah, I can imagine. I know that, you know, we all were feeling very isolated, but some of us had pods, you know what I mean? Some of us had community within our community that's okay, we can hang out together, this and that. So I can just imagine how isolated and how scary that must have been for some of our LGBTQIA2 spirit youth going through. But I know they were so grateful for organizations like the Wanda Alston Foundation and just community just coming together and trying to make something like normal or fix some of the issues. So yeah, I can't imagine. And you know, the stigma about mental health services. Can you tell me what challenges you guys have providing mental health services, or maybe just changing the minds of the youth, the LGBTQIA2 spirited youth, towards being more open to mental health and talking to someone about their feelings, being vulnerable, being naked, and just out there and trying to work through their issues?
A really good question. These types of conversations are really the thing that changes that, right? Like when individuals in all aspects of their life are having conversations around how normal it is to need therapy, to need support, to need community, I think it's really important. Some of the obstacles that we encountered really was culturally competent queer providers, right? Like our youth have figured out how to survive. And they survive on their instincts and, you know, with the ability to either read a person quickly and determine whether they can trust them. And the ways in which we were forced to provide therapy and support through things like Zoom and remote are not the ways in which they connect. Right? It's not the ways in which they build relationships and build trust. And so there, we are asking them, we are hopeful that they will take advantage of programming like therapy and, you know, behavioral support, but we're creating it in this space that just doesn't really work for them and for most youth. And so it was really, really hard. the manner in which they needed to access the services, but even further, right? Like looking across the screen at somebody that doesn't look like you, that doesn't love like you, that doesn't partner like you, and that isn't in similar situations or circumstances or have lived as, you know, like a similar experience, it's really hard to connect. I mean, as a person that has resources and has a Kia house, you know, that would be challenging for me. And so imagining, you know, these kiddos having to get over all of the trauma and discrimination and rejection and harm that has been created around them and in their lives, and ask them to just connect to this random person on a screen and to be vulnerable, like you said, that nakedness, that truthfulness, that vulnerability that a person has to be in the right space to do, you know, it really just wasn't there for them. And so that, you know, just created a lot of obstacles for us.
So I work in education, and at my school, I'm a liaison for our LGBTQIA plus youth. And one thing that I've been noticing a lot of is that we have students who are kind of out, but also kind of closeted in a way to be able to stay in their homes, right? So, you know, the give and take that they have to do in order to, you know, become a, you know, successful, thriving member of their family or whatever, a lot of them do not take up the opportunities that are out there by such places as Wanda House because of the fact that, you know, they have so many other responsibilities. So as myself being an advocate, I know oftentimes I try my best to kind of empower youth to, seek therapy, you know, kind of give the idea. It's kind of like dating, you know, like,
right.
if it doesn't work out, right. It's okay to say no, you know, it's okay to say, I no longer, you know, want this, this isn't working for me, and ask them to provide you with other spaces. June, can you like speak more to that? Like, do you have a young people who like drop in or, you know, like kind of are at home, but can't fully be them, be their themselves in their households and stuff like that?
You are absolutely spot on that they have to like thread this incredibly complicated needle of who can I be open and honest with? Where can I be fully authentic and present? And where are the places that I need to scale back and not, you know, show up fully? And if you, NJ, you know this with the educational system, if people are not safe and showing up fully, then they're not going to be able to really learn the things that they need to while they're in the educational space. It puts them further and further behind because they're trying to navigate all of these systems of safety, just pure safety of, is this adult okay? Do they have my back? Are they going to, you know, think about my best interests? And so that's complicated for anyone. And for someone that's not, you know, fully developed, it's horrendous for them to navigate that. Our space is sometimes the first space, although no one wants to experience homelessness or rejection by their family. Sometimes it is the only space that they could fully show up. And so we see you show up, you know, not really embracing their queerness or their identity or their non-binary status or their trans status, showing up very timid and very uncertain and very scared. And then you see them when they see that it's a safe space and that it is full of other people that are very similar on a very similar journey, the way in which they blossom, the way in which they connect with others and build, you know, really come into themselves is really kind of amazing. We provide services to only individuals at our shelters, only the individuals that are living at our shelters. But as I mentioned, we have a counseling center in which we provide therapy and case management for individuals. And, you know, that is open to everyone that is experiencing homelessness, intimate partner violence, sexual assault, need a place to go and lay down those really heavy things. And we try to, you know, make sure that folks are connected to places in which they can drop in, whether it's the DC Center or Smile or LAYC or other programming that has a drop-in space. So, for sure. Schools, we're trying to make work with and make safer. Like, it's our queer kids are everywhere. Too many of our queer kids are impacted by homelessness and intimate partner violence. And so we all have to know how to keep them safe and where they can go to be safe. And so it takes a village.
Oh, for sure. And I just wanted to definitely shout out to all of the educators who are out and about in their schools and make their children, their students feel safe. And like, this is a safe space. If you want to talk to me about any, you know, it's very impactful. And it's like you said, like, LGBTQIA, two, folks are everywhere all throughout the schools. Like, folks are so like, oh no, I don't like gay people. Your student's teacher, your student's principal, your child's counselor, like the gay folks, we the queers are all up and through the schools and whatnot. So I just wanted to shout out all the educators who are making a safe space for our young folks who are trying to figure it all out. And it just starts with relationship and building that relationship so that they can be vulnerable, so that they can know that, hey, you are human, but you do care about me. We are making mistakes, but you are genuinely trying to do what's best for me as a member of the community. So I just wanted to shout out the educators as well.
Your point on queer kids seeing queer adults.
Yeah. Is
just so important, right? Like, they need to see examples of the possibilities.
Visibilities.
It's impossible to hope for a future that you don't see yourself in, that you don't see others like you in. And so having that representation, having teachers and administrators and, you know, janitors and bus drivers and everybody, looking and embracing in the ways that are important, like, it's essential to their well-being. And
indeed,
you know, we've got to make sure that our teachers are safe to be authentic and live openly and represent the community and show themselves as models and mentors for our queer individuals.
That part, a funny story. I went into a class. I used to be a dean of students. So I went into the class, was just walking in, and it was like, Miss Rice. I'm like, what's up? I said, you a stud? I said, oh my Lord, precious lamb. I said, okay, now look, I will answer all the questions that you want, you know, answered appropriately, of course. But right now in the middle class, it's not the time for that. But I was just, and then somebody said, well, are you? But it was just really, it was really special that they felt so, so
and
free to,
thirsty and hungry.
Yeah.
See that they were excited and it was an example. And even if it wasn't that you them that you know was a part of the community, they knew somebody, they had a friend, they had a sibling, you know, and so they're looking, they're paying attention, and we need to be very much aware of that.
Indeed. So we have a few more minutes until break, but I definitely wanted to talk about reunification. What is reunification and how do you guys support that process? You know, we're talking about community and safety and feeling good about yourself and growth. So like, What is that reunification process?
Yeah, safety is, you know, kind of the foremost thing that we are concerned about. When our youth join our program, we bring them into our program with an initial assessment. And really, it's a little bit of a, where have they been? What are the services that they need now? Where do they hope to go? And part of that is talking about, you know, their family of origin relationship and whether they're still connected in any way. And whether they have hopes or dreams of reconnecting, because the truth of the matter is that regardless of how poorly a queer kid has been treated in their mm-hmm. family, they want to be in that family.
Yep.
They want to be accepted. They want to be welcomed. They want to be loved. And so if there's an opportunity for us to help to navigate, you know, a family getting to a place where they can welcome their queer kids back safely back into the home, we try to make sure that there are resources for the parents or, you know, the caregivers to be educated, to be connected to support systems, to be able to ask questions, to deal with, you know, kind of the reconciliation of who they thought their kid was going to be and who their kid is. And so if we can help facilitate that, we work to do that. It is rare.
Okay.
That it happens. And it is rare that it is successful.
Yeah.
But the other piece of the truth is that even though the kids are staying in our program during holidays or during breaks or during different times, they try to reconnect. They try to stay connected. They are, you know, trying to go home for a couple days, trying to spend the weekend, you know, with their family. And we try to safety plan with them around what are the things that they need to do? What are the resources, you know, how we could get them a bus trip back if things go sideways, you know, in the middle of, you know, a visit mm-hmm. or things of that nature. And so, you know, again, it's about safety. And if they're safe and if they, you know, will remain safe in that space, you know, we're supportive. But the moment that they're not, then we seek other processes to make sure that they're kept okay.
Awesome. I love how thorough you guys are, like a safety plan, like transportation. All of these things are so very important. You know, and it kind of made me sad when you said they're usually not successful, you know, because it's I just feel like it's a lot of unlearning that everybody has to do. The families have to unlearn some things, like, you know, and it's just basically all about love, what it boils down to, you know. So, and that need, that yearning to be a part of where you came from is so strong that even though you've been mistreated and set aside and pushed away, your heart still longs to be with your family. But it's a beautiful thing that family is not just blood. Family is what you make, the people who show up for you, the people who love you, the people who show you that they love you. And it's your community, it's your tribe. So I just want to say that to all of the young LGBTQIA2 spirit folks out there who are trying to reconcile with their family, but may not be successful. But you have family, you got a tribe, you have people, you have the Wanda Alston Foundation, you have June Crenshaw and all the wonderful workers there. But my goodness, I'm getting a little emotional. I was like, gosh. But yeah, I'm so grateful for the work that you all do. So grateful. Jay, did you want to say something before we go on to break?
Yeah, I'm just like sitting here, like taking this all in, because it is a journey, you know, working with youth and trying to make sure that they are safe and, you know, getting the things necessary for adulthood, right? Because, you know, youth, what is the transition plan for young people who stay at the Wanda Alston House? Like, do they, how long do they get to stay? You know, is there some sort of plan that is in place to transition the youth out into adulthood?
Great question.
So, that's a great question. So we've got two different types of programs, one in which they can stay up to 24 months. So, you know, roughly 2 years. And then we have an extended transitional housing program that, depending on when they join the program, they could stay up to 6 years. The youth that we serve are transitional age youth, and that is defined by individuals between the ages of 18 and 24. And so based on their experiences, what I will say is that no one make or seldom, let me correct that. It is seldom that a youth can come to our program having been rejected and discriminated and experiencing all the trauma and get acclimated, find a job that allows them to pay $3,000 for a studio apartment in DC. Ooh. Get themselves, you know, kind of, you know, stabilized so that they can walk out of our program in 2 years. That just doesn't happen. It's not, you know, that's where there's opportunities for more work. And so on average, youth stay in our 2 year program about 3.5 years. So I'll just let that land.
Okay. Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, it takes time. Definitely takes time. But speaking of time, Jay, you want to take us to break?
Yes, we are going to have our station break right now.
I'm Jay Barber from the Inside Out Collective, and you are enjoying The House That Wanda Built on WPFW Washington.
Peace, good people. It's Daffo from the Inside Out Collective and A Gay Old Time and the Fellowship Hall. Back in 2023, Jay Barber and I had an interview with June Crenshaw in honor of the house that Wanda built. She's the former executive director of the Wanda Alston Foundation. She just stepped down, and Cesar Toledo is now the new executive director. But we hope you enjoy this interview, and we hope you're enjoying this day of programming. Much love to you all, and much love to the legacy and life of Wanda Alston here on WPFW Washington.
So the organization does amazing work and is vital and valuable, but you also can't pull youth out of poverty. What other supports do LGBTQ youth need?
Another brilliant question. So you're right. Like, our program is a band-aid on a bullet wound, right? So we place youth into our shelter program. We provide case management and connection to medical and mental health care. We connect them to educational opportunities and help them to find, you know, job opportunities if there are available. But really, our youth are experiencing homelessness for a couple of reasons. One, because they've been rejected by their family and they've experienced high levels of trauma. And then the other is because they're poor. And so we don't have infrastructure either in our program or in citywide programs that takes a poor, queer, Black or brown individual experiencing homelessness from their status to sustainability. We have programs such as ours that stabilize and create safety and connect to services, but that bridge to sustainability is a real opportunity for our organization and citywide and the community to start figuring out how to solve. Now, we all know that education and, you know, job development opportunities and what we talked about earlier, mental health and behavioral health stability, is really what connects our youth to sustainable jobs and opportunities that are going to pull themselves out of poverty so that they can afford their own house and be able to pay their rent and connect. The other option is that there are programs within the city like permanent supportive housing or rapid rehousing programs to help those that are those extreme cases. But the majority of individuals we serve need job opportunities, need educational opportunities, and need to be given an opportunity to come in and do work and develop experience and to be hired, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that we pride ourselves on is hiring from the community so that youth can see, like we mentioned, representation of people that are either queer or have lived experience or, you know, like other ways in which they're on a similar path. And so one of the things is to just to expect, you know, the larger community, particularly, you know, in D.C., to hire more of our queer, trans, gender nonconforming folks and to create a work environment that is safe for the trauma that they are carrying so that they could be successful in those jobs.
Yeah.
That was a lot.
No, it sounds like it takes a whole village and then some. It's like a lot of wraparound services, a lot of I know that we got the LAYC Career Academy that's ages 16 to 24. You go ahead and get some GED training. And I know like the Goodwill Academy there. So there are some educational opportunities popping, like organizations popping up in DC that lead students straight into the job pipeline, a medical assistant, computer, A+, things of that nature. But I think it needs to be a whole bunch more collaboration between all of these programs and like the Wanda Austin Foundation, all the things that help the marginalized, those we call them opportunity youth. But you call them something else, the age 16, 18 through 24, the transitional, I don't know, but we used to call them opportunity.
Age.
Yes. Yeah. But I guess it's changed since, you know, terminology is always changing. But I think that all the folks that work with transitional youth, you know, the more collaboration, the better. Like nobody's trying to win more than anybody else. If the students or the youth are winning, then we all are winning. Go ahead, Jay. I'm sorry. I know you're about to say something.
I was just wondering, like, what are some of the ways that we can kind of ease some of the hurdles for queer youth when it comes to job opportunities? Because I working with youth and getting them to understand, you know, the overarching societal, you know, norms and what expectations are that, you know, other youth get throughout the, you know, schooling and programs and stuff like that. What is unique when it comes to queer youth? Like how can organizations, jobs, people show up for them in ways that, you know, we don't necessarily, I feel like, you know, larger society just doesn't necessarily implant those skills.
Yeah, that's a good question. One of the things we do a lot of collaborations with a lot of, you know, organizations because, you know, as has been mentioned several times, it really takes a village.
Yeah.
As you are Bar, that, you know, just opened, I guess, a little bit over a year ago, have like this informal agreement with us and other queer serving organizations to prioritize hiring our youth, to get them some standard basic job experiences, knowing, you know, really sometimes it's just life development things, like knowing that you need to show up on time and that you need to be there the whole day and that you've got to complete these particular tasks and et cetera. So those types of life development skills. But the bigger thing that they recognize as queer organizations is that our youth are showing up with their trauma. They don't get to leave it at home or pack it away. Their triggers, their trauma, their rejection, Their lack of support from family and community, the fact that there's limited mental health services, et cetera, means that they show up at work and sometimes they can't do a job. They don't have the capacity to do what's necessary and needed in that day. And so the important part is having a trauma-informed workspace that recognizes, like, some days these kids can't get out of bed because of what they're holding and what they're, you know, carrying. And so you're going to have to deal with more call-outs, more I need to leave early, more lack of, you know, kind of managing crises in personal lives. Like, all of that stuff is going to show up in the work environment. And so it needs to be an environment of empathy and understanding. Like, I hear you, and here's some of the tools that you can use in order to support you. You know, really not, you know, holding youth accountable, but creating a space where they get to learn, they get to make mistakes, they get to fall, and we're still standing there in support and cheering them on to get up and succeed and try again tomorrow and go a little bit further. And so, like, it is those types of things that really make the difference. And, you know, again, if these youth are really accustomed at determining their safety really quickly, right? Determining whether they want, you know, they need a job. They want a job because they want to get out of poverty and they want to get out of a homeless shelter. But, you know, the day-to-day of being able to work through all of the obstacles to getting to that ultimate goal is really a heavy lift.
Right. For sure.
It seems to go directly against capitalism. Like, idea of having empathy and compassion for another person and what they're going through. Like, yeah, I feel like a lot of workspaces could use that.
And if you think about, like, DC has some of the most progressive laws in the nation, right?
Yeah.
And so it's a mecca, right? Like, it's a place where all the queers want to come, and they're showing up with their degrees and their experience and their connection and their know-how and all of that. And so if you, you know, put, you know, kind of throw a queer Black and brown individual that has experienced housing instability and family rejection and trauma against a privileged situation in which, you know, we're competing for the same job, and, you know, it's just not a level playing field.
Yeah.
And so we have to be mindful of the fact that, you know, they're showing up with all of this heavy weight, right? They're carrying pounds and pounds of rock, and we're carrying feathers. And there's a difference of, you know, how we're having to navigate it. And I'm really thrilled that we have a city that queer folks feel safe in and want to come to, and et cetera. But even in DC, there's two or three different lived experiences here, right? For individuals that are navigating, you know, what a DC experience is. It's our vulnerable kids have a significant disadvantage, and the numbers are growing, you know?
Right?
So
it is
from 2022 to 2023, there was probably a 10% increase in the number of individuals that are unhoused, not the ones that are in our shelter, you know, but those that are living in cars or, you know, sleeping on benches or in tents and, you know, encampments. All of this is occurring. We do not have enough resources for the individuals that are experiencing homelessness. And so there's this big need, and there's this lack of job opportunities, and there's this lived experience that's very different. It's a lot. And I'm glad to be here talking about it because it's heavy to carry.
Oh, yeah. Glad you're here, too.
I want to give a shout out to Joe and Rach at
yes.
So I appreciate that they're out here doing some of the work, you know, like, because that is needed. It's really important. And it sounds like some of the skills and things that they're giving the youth, you know, are helping them move forward for even other opportunities.
And I think other queer business owners need to take a note from their book. Hire the young LGBTQIA too. Do it. You queer, you own a business, got a little juice bar, got a little this and that. Hire some, you know, hire them, hire the community. If you're trauma informed, that spoke to me. And if you're used to fight or flight all the time, that's what you're going to go to. It's not going to be like a self-regulation. It's not going to be like, okay, let me calm down. Okay, I am at work. It's going to be harder for that to happen. So definitely being trauma-informed and just having empathy and compassion. And it's not all about money all the time. It will work out, okay? Good grief. But yes, that leads it to the next question, right, Jay?
Yep. So what are some of the goals for Wanda House for the next few years? What are some of the bright spots or things that you all are looking forward to?
That's a really good question, too. I am so impressed with the questions. You know, the need is growing. It has been growing at a breakneck speed. And so we want to continue to provide services to the many, many hundreds of youth that are currently unhoused. That is an important goal. The other part of our work is around making sure that the services that we provide meet the current need. Mm. We're a program that started in, you know, 2008. And what was going on at that time and what's happening now is change. And so the services we provide, the way in which we deliver it, the way in which we support our youth has to evolve with that. And so back to that trauma-informed, youth-centered perspective of, you know, kind of letting our youth tell us what type of programming and support they need in order for them to be successful, and tailoring programs to what that need is. Like, all of our youth, you know, obviously are experiencing homelessness, but the path in which they came to that homelessness is different for each person. And so making sure that we are in a position to tailor the programming to what is needed. We think it's important to own in the city and ground ourselves in the community that we work with. We're proud to be in Ward 7. That was our flagship location, and we're committed to remaining where the biggest need is, which is Ward 7 and 8. Yeah. But we know that homelessness and services need to be everywhere. And so we want to buy property and grow our programming. I don't think it's any secret that, unfortunately, one of the bigger programs in the city, Casa Ruby, was forced to close their doors in 2022. And so that meant that, you know, 24 beds that were available to LGBTQIA2 spirited youth are gone.
Yeah.
Right. So the need's growing, but the amount of, you know, inventory out in the city is lowering. So, you know, working with the city to make sure that that gap is met, and that if it's not a program like ours or Smile that is LGBTQIA two-spirited led and focus, that every program is culturally competent and knows how to deal with and support queer youth that are experiencing homelessness, and that these programs are not going to further traumatize our youth. And so that work is really what we see in our immediate future.
Yeah,
and then obviously figuring out how to eradicate, you know, poverty.
That's, for sure. Wow. Yeah. Y'all doing the work. Y'all doing the work, child.
We are trying. We are certainly trying.
So what's something that we can do to honor Wanda Alston's legacy?
You know, I feel so humbled to be in this role, carrying on the work that Wanda started all of those years ago. I will say that I met Wanda only a couple of months before her death. And at the time, I met her because she was working, as Kurt mentioned, to create, you know, sort of a housing summit, a queer housing summit to talk about the need in the community and what was happening or where there was a big lack in services. And so she was pitching that. She was showing up at events like Black Lesbian Support and other spaces where we gather to talk about, you know, kind of the challenges we were dealing with all those years ago. And so what is important to continue in her legacy is for this really vital work to be sourced and resourced to continue, right? Like, this work is so essential. She saw the need for addressing homelessness, addressing addiction, addressing mental health challenges, addressing the fact that intimate partner violence and sexual assault occurs in our community. And she worked really hard to elevate all of those things that weren't the sexy things to talk about. She was that, you know, kind of, you know, fly in the ointment to say, oh, but wait about this, you know, what about this situation? And what about our really vulnerable members of the community? And so we need to keep that up. And we also need to pass on the history of the work that she did. If there's a generation behind us that is also experiencing very similar situations, but don't know the work that she put in and others put in, you know, we're always going to be at a disadvantage if we don't know our history and we don't know, you know, what journey and what shoulders we're standing on right now. And so that's important in her legacy, is keeping her story alive, keeping the work she was passionate about going, making sure that that no member of our community is left behind.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Man, so we already talked about capitalism. So we need to talk about that money, 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 money. So how can we support the foundation? How can we support? Who do we send money to? And send the monies, people, okay? Send them money.
I will say send the money. We get about 75% of our funding from, you know, either local or federal sources. So that means 25% of it I'm out paving, walking, looking for the money, trying to fill the gap. And so you know, sustaining donors and, you know, one-time donors are real essential to keeping the lights on, paying the bills, you know, all of those things. And so donations are really, really important. We could use help with volunteers joining our board and making sure that, you know, the mission is in alignment with the work. You know, coming in and helping around our facility, et cetera, but really spreading the word about the work that we do. And so you can go to www.wandaalstonfoundation.org to donate. You can send, you know, a check or, you know, however you want to donate, there's all those different ways. We're on all the social media platforms, Facebook and Instagram and I started to say TikTok, but I don't think we're there.
That's awesome.
But all the other social media. So reach out and connect with us. And we are send an email to contact us at WandaAlstonFoundation.org. Join our monthly newsletters and we will send out updates to you. There's always so much need. So
yes. Okay. Please. We have to wrap it up. Ms. Crenshaw, thank you so much. Yes. Thank you so much. It's been the Fellowship Hall on Inside Out. Thank you, Jay Barbage. Thank you, Ms. Crenshaw. Thank all of you guys. It's more programming coming up. Shout out to Lee, our producer. Those questions came from Lee.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. Today, the Senate kicked off its marathon voting session, or Votorama, on President Trump's self-proclaimed Big Beautiful Bill. A Votorama allows senators to propose an unlimited number of amendments to budget-related measures, and after brief debate, the amendments are each voted on in rapid succession. Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, which he says is essential to his agenda of making America great again, involves huge changes, including $175 billion for deportations and border wall construction, permanent extensions of his 2017 tax cuts, elimination of taxes on tips and overtime, tax relief for seniors on Social Security, and a boosted child tax credit. Meanwhile, critics of the Big Beautiful Bill warn that it could add $3.8 trillion to the national debt and cut Medicaid, potentially affecting 8.6 million people. Earlier this month, a number of people were injured in Boulder, Colorado, at an event held in support of hostages in Gaza. The attacker, Mohammed Sabri Soleiman, set people on fire by using a makeshift flamethrower and Molotov cocktails, which are bottles filled with flammable liquid that are ignited. No deaths occurred until now. The Boulder County District Attorney's Office revealed today that an 82-year-old woman, Karen Diamond, has died tragically as a result of the severe injuries that she suffered in that attack. Therefore, the charges against Mohammed Soleiman have been upgraded. He was indicted last week on 12 hate crime counts in the attack. He is accused of trying to kill the 8 people who were hurt when he threw those cocktails at them and other people nearby. In response to Ms. Diamond's death, Colorado Governor Jared Polis said in a statement, and I quote, "This loss is deeply felt by the Boulder community and our entire state, particularly within our strong Jewish community. Karen was taken from us too soon, and we mourn her loss while remembering her life and the impact she had on those who loved her," end quote. A community in Idaho is mourning the loss of 2 first responders who were killed in the line of duty over the weekend. Yesterday afternoon, firefighters responded to a brush fire in a mountainous area of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. But before they could put out the fire, they were shot at multiple times by a man with a rifle. 2 firefighters were killed by the gunfire, while another injured firefighter is in stable condition after undergoing surgery. According to Kootenai County Sheriff Robert Norris, at least 300 law enforcement officers gathered at the scene, some of whom exchanged gunfire with the suspect, who has now been identified as Wes Rowley. Authorities believe that Rowley acted alone, luring the firefighters to the scene with the fire in order to ambush them. After an hours-long manhunt for Rowley, he was found dead last evening at the top of the mountain where he started the blaze. Authorities are trying to determine his motive. In honor of the slain firefighters, hundreds of Coeur d'Alene residents participated in a miles-long procession during which time that the firefighters' bodies were transported from the Kootenai County Hospital to Spokane, Washington. Beginning tomorrow, Tuesday, July 1st, dozens of new laws will take effect in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Here's an example of one new law per city or state. In D.C., the minimum wage will increase 45 cents from $17.50 to $17.95. In Maryland, adults will be able to take the General Educational Development or GED test in Spanish in addition to English. The Maryland Department of Labor will also be looking into offering the GED test in other languages as well. In Virginia, the cost of certain breast cancer screenings will be billed to the insurance company, not the patient. Again, those new laws and others will begin taking effect tomorrow, Tuesday, July 1st. In today's weather, it's currently about 92 degrees.